Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Haaretz podcast. I'm Linda Dayan in Tel Aviv. Saturday night marked a turning point for Israel, the region, and beyond. Iran launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel from its own territory, this time opting not to hide behind its many proxies in the region. The vast majority of these were intercepted, and the massive strike left minimal damage. But this story is far from over. To understand the attack, what brought us here, and what might follow, I'm speaking with Haaretz's editor-in-chief Aluf Ben and Arash Azizi, a contributing writer to The Atlantic and author of What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. To better understand the attack, we're going to be speaking to Haaretz's editor-in-chief Aluf Ben. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello.
So when it comes to this particular, very unprecedented attack for Israel, what brought us to this point?
Well, we've been at war for several months, and with each side trying to expand it or to find different paths to fight it, beginning with Hezbollah in Lebanon, joining the Hamas attack with kind of calibrated attacks on Israel, which were very successful in depopulating the border area of the Israeli towns and villages, and ongoing use of rockets, anti-tank missiles, and so on from there, attacking military installations, killing or wounding Israeli soldiers, losing some of the royal personnel at the time, fighting in Gaza going on, and what Israel is called is termed the war between the wars that has been fought in Syria, mostly through Israeli air attacks on Iranian or pro-Iranian militias or Hezbollah installations, armed convoys, armed factories and so on in Syrian territory, but not targeting the Syrian army itself, was still going on and even intensified. And as part of that, Israel killed this Iranian commander of the Al-Quds force in the region and some of his accomplices. That adds up to a list of previous Israeli operations in Iran. The most famous ones was the assassination of Fakhrizadeh, of the chief Iranian nuclear scientist, in Tehran in late 2020, to be followed by an attack on an Iranian drone base near the town of Kermanshah in February 2022, that at the time Israel did not claim any responsibility for, but recently during this war, former Prime Minister Bennett took credit for this operation, and having been the Prime Minister at the time, which was kind of a political gap. But Netanyahu showing, Netanyahu was talking about bombing Iran and attacking its nuclear facilities for years, and you see, I was the one who actually attacked Iran and destroyed their drone air force. Well, not enough, or they rebuilt it since then. And apparently for the Iranians, the attack on their commander in Damascus was one attack too much.
So what did the attack on Saturday night look like?
Well, it looked like hundreds of drones, which are slow-flying pilotless aircraft that need to pass like 9 hours between Iran and Israel to reach the targets, which gives you a lot of time to prepare and to shoot them down if you have air defenses. Iran doesn't have that kind of air defenses in its own territory. Neither has Syria, but Israel has. The other was cruise missiles that fly somewhat faster. And last but not least, ballistic missiles that could fly directly from Iran to Israel with a large warhead. They did not try to surprise anybody. They announced the attack. They announced the launching of these drones. And at the same time, Israel and its allies in the region, most prominently the United States, but this was also aided by British and French air forces and the Jordanian Air Force participating in shooting down drones and cruise missiles over Jordanian territory. And I guess that other parts in the region, the Saudis, the Bahrainis, the Emiratis, at least by supplying, you know, air defense radar data or other intelligence or what have you, because some of these missiles and drones flew over their territory, especially those that were launched from Yemen. So you saw kind of regional alliance that was not ad hoc. It was designed and managed by the Americans, by the American Central Command for a couple of years now. One of the main changes in the American security structure in the region that was part of the Abraham Accords structure was to move Israel from the responsibility of EUCOM to CENTCOM, which maybe to folks who are not interested in military affairs, it just sounds like military acronyms, bureaucratic. But in truth, the idea was that Israel, since the other Arab militaries and American allies in the region, most prominently the Saudis, would not cooperate directly with Israel, Israel was delegated to EUCOM as part of the European command, whose main task was and still is to defend Western Europe from Russia. Now, as part of CENTCOM, Israel could be part of the regional drills and the regional defense system that was built to anticipate such an attack from Iran or from Iranian allies in the region against Israel or against any other pro-American ally in the area. And this was one of the lessons of the failure to protect the Saudi oil facilities in 2018 when the Iranians attacked them with a much smaller force and were able to destroy or to create a lot of damage to these unique and very crucial infrastructures.
Usually in the past, when Iran wanted to strike Israel, it just acted through one of its proxies, whether it be Hezbollah, usually, or the Houthis in Yemen. Why would they take this step to attack directly from Iranian territory if it's going to take so much longer? Is it psychological?
I think that they wanted to send a message to Israel that there's a limit to their willingness to absorb, on one hand, and on the other hand, to show even obliquely some kind of support to Hezbollah or to Hamas in Gaza, although they insistently did not say that this was a retaliation for what Israel is doing in Gaza. This was not in support for Hamas or for any Palestinian cause. They did not say once that if Israel would be willing to stop the fire in Gaza or to do whatever for the Palestinians or even vis-a-vis Hezbollah or whatever, they would not retaliate. It was a kind of bilateral action. You hit us, we hit you. And clearly it's a very daring operation on the part of Iran, not just because of the risk of escalation, but also because it showed Israel and the entire world that it can hit Israel from its territory. Something that was talked for many, many years by intelligence experts and missile experts and so on. But now it's clear that it can happen. And remember, some of these missiles hit the Israeli Air Force base in Nevatim, which is in the desert. It's not surrounded by major populated areas, like other air bases that are in populated areas. But if those several missiles that actually penetrated the Israeli air defense would have hit Tel Aviv or any other big city, we would have been in a very different situation. So they could not trust that. You know, the idea that everything was choreographed and they gave warning in advance and they were sure that everything would be okay. No, like, you know, after October 7, I think we all have to be very skeptical of premediated military outcomes. We know it both for Israel and for that matter for Hamas as well. You know what you plan. Clearly, this time, unlike October 7, the Israeli Air Force, the Israeli military was very well prepared. But still, some missiles did penetrate the defensive shield. And if they had launched not 100 or so ballistic missiles, but 1,000, just for the sake of argument, clearly it could have been a very devastative outcome and clearly a very different political and strategic outcome as well. The relatively low damage enables Israel to at least to think twice and be encouraged and prodded by its allies not to retaliate immediately. This would not have been the case had there been mass casualties or mass destruction in Israel.
So What does this mean for the ongoing war in Gaza, especially considering how much attention has been deviated away from the fighting in the Gaza Strip?
Well, I think it shows Hamas that at this stage, at least, they are still friendless. Nobody is going to come to help them. And they must therefore, as they do, they must try and play the only card that they still have, which is, maybe they have two cards. One is the Israeli hostages. And the other is the pressure on Israel not to attack Rafah and not to go against the final stronghold of Hamas in southern Gaza, where most of the Gaza population is now packed from mostly from the depopulated areas in northern Gaza. So for Hamas, you know, they have to come to terms with reality. But that doesn't relieve Israel from A, the ongoing burden of the war in Gaza, including the hostages, including the depopulated areas along the borders in the south and the north. It doesn't relieve Israel from the ongoing fight with Hezbollah in the north that only intensified in recent weeks. As we hear less about Israeli operations in Gaza, we hear more about what's going on in the north. And therefore, the war is still going on. It's not over yet. And the Iranian attack, although it was directed at relatively remote corners of Israel, did remind the wider Israeli population that we are still at war, that we can still be attacked, that we could still might find ourselves, as happened in parts of Israel, forced to run to the shelters late at night if we have shelters. In the Bedouin villages around the Air Force base, there are no shelters, and one little child was severely wounded because of the shrapnel. So I think it was a very stark blow to the kind of normal life that resurfaced in Israel, especially in the Tel Aviv area or in Jerusalem after several months of fighting.
In that same vein, I feel like a lot of Israelis have the same question on their mind, which is, what now? What's going to be happening next? What could a retaliation look like? What could a lack of retaliation look like?
I believe that in any further future attempt to hit at an Iranian facility or an Iranian senior official or anything, or Iranian military unit and so on, the Israeli decision makers would think not twice, but 10 times about the consequences, which clearly they overlooked in deciding to kill that Iranian general in Damascus. And by the way, in the same way that they are thinking twice and more before any attack in Lebanon, because they don't want Hezbollah to escalate the war and turn it into a Tel Aviv versus Beirut missile and bombing war. That's one thing. And about retaliation, look, the recipe is endless. But one thing is clear, that Israel would have, again, to think twice about alliances. Clearly, if you want to fight Iran, and this was shown on Sunday night, you need the early warning capabilities, if not the defensive capabilities of your allies in the region, and first and foremost, the United States. And if the United States would tell you not to attack, then or you know, you're on your own, then it's a very, very difficult calculation and a lot of risk to take. And clearly the Iranians said that if there's retaliation, there would be a counter retaliation, and so on and so forth. There are factions in the Israeli cabinet, the far right, and to some extent, I mean, part of Netanyahu, I think, inclines in that direction, who believe that a wider war is better for Israel, because then it could ignore whatever external pressure there is not to finish the job in Gaza, to the settlers and their supporters in cabinet, be another opportunity to attack the Palestinians in the West Bank and drive some of them out, and so on and so forth, and with the damages to Israel, but bringing it to the ultimate victory against the Palestinians and so on. And knowing that Israel's allies and President Biden, above all, are trying to limit Israeli actions and to have a very close oversight of Israeli military preparations, plans, and so on. The American and European involvement and Gulf involvement and so on is not just because of their sudden urge to protect Israel. That's part of it. But it's also protecting the West from original war that would drive the oil prices skyrocketing, with all the implications that this would have on the re-election chances of President Biden. So this and others in the West. So it's not just about good-hearted and good-natured support for an ally. It's also a top strategic interest of the West to avoid another energy crisis at this point.
Thank you so much, Aluf Ben, for coming in and giving us a fantastic rundown of what happened and perhaps what's to come.
Thank you.
For Israelis, Saturday night was marked by panic, anxiety, and fear as news of Iran's missile and drone launches drove the country into shelters to wait hours for the strikes to come. Arash Azizi, a contributing writer to The Atlantic and author of What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom, wrote in his latest article that the people of Iran know that their main enemy is at home and that the war will bring them only more repression and hardship. He says that the mood among average Iranians was pretty similar to what the average Israeli was facing, and the streets were anything but celebratory. Can you tell us a bit about what you were hearing from friends and relatives in Iran on Saturday night?
It was a really scary time. I think a lot of Iranians were really worried as to what the war will bring. You know, as usual, I saw there was a lot of humor in Israel, same in Iran, a lot of what you can call it, the gallows humor, people trying to make fun of this, what is in many ways an absurd situation. I say absurd because, you know, Iran has a lot of problems. Average Iranians have a lot of problems, economic, you know, the repression that they face from the government. The last thing they can afford is to enter a war with Israel, a country in which, you know, for which there is very little hostility amongst the Iranian public. So I think there was a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of anger at the government that is now getting them potentially involved in a conflict that they really want very little to do with.
Do you think at all that this might help kind of bring about more of the protests that we already saw against the regime?
You know, how protests break out, it's always really unpredictable. There have been tons of protests, as you know, and there's also ongoing protests all the time. It's the question of which one will be able to break out. And yes, there is a precedent, of course, for military conflict, for the threat of military conflict to lead to popular uprisings. The problem in Iran is that that path has been tried a lot before, and it does have some fundamental problems. Unfortunately, when Iranians came out in mass numbers to oppose the government, they were unable to find political leadership. They were unable to find political alternatives that could be really opposed to the regime. And they're faced with a regime that has remained united at its base. I think it has the loyalty of something like 10-15% of the society, but its numbers are very organized. It has brutal security forces at its power. It has killed hundreds of Iranians on the street. So I think a lot of people will think twice before coming out to protest. Having said that, you know, it could occur at any time again. On the very same day as Iran was lobbing missiles and drones at Israel, on the very same day, like literally a few hours before, the Iranian police started a new phase, if you will, of social repression. It started a new phase of putting, cracking down on women on the Iranian streets for not covering their hair. Now, millions of Iranian women in the last few months have been in the last couple of years, I have to say, following the Women, Life, Freedom movement that broke out in 2022, they have been, you know, engaged in what you can call a campaign of mass civil disobedience, by refusing to cover their hair, refusing to honor the mandatory hijab rule. And the government, just on the very same day as it attacked Israel, it started a new campaign of wanting to push that and enforce it on women. It has also already started, unfortunately, because there's all, we have all these news and all these, you know, strategic news about war and the size of the missiles and the, you know, how long they'll take and, you know, this kind of military bros, if you will, often dominate the news in such times. You know, we're missing some important part of the news. For example, Iran has started a new campaign of repression in relation to war. There are online accounts that are harassing and publishing screenshots of people in Iran who had expressed worry about war. I'm not even talking about people who would say, you know, they hate the government or anything. People who did so much as saying, what is the most human reaction to this news that you and I will have, or anybody who's trying to live there will have, as in, you know, what's going to happen to prices now? God damn it, you know, we can't afford it, or hashtag no to war, things like that. And the government is already harassing them. If they might have already actually arrested some people who did that, they certainly threatened them with that. And they've asked people to sort of report on those who do that. And in fact, a very established journalist who wrote an editorial expressing worry about the war in a major reformist newspaper in Tehran has also, I think, been summoned already, or been threatened with being summoned. I speak to some of the regular people who are regular critiques of foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. I'm talking about sort of establishment critiques, those who are, you know, they were former diplomats or they're professors at the University of Tehran, and they're afraid of speaking out. So the regime, it's very clear that it will use whatever this conflict is going to be to repress its domestic critiques, and it would, you know, it's a new vista for the Iranian opposition as well to oppose the war, but also oppose this regime that, you know, that has bring nothing good for Iranians, that now has threatened our country with a war that none of us want.
So here in Israel, usually during wartime, you see this rise in jingoism, especially in the beginning, this very we're all in this together mood. I was wondering if a similar thing could come about in Iran, if there could be a rallying in support of the regime if a war does break out, or if the repression of the government is so strong and so strict that it keeps that from happening.
I don't think Iranians can rally to the regime just because this regime is very, really widely hated in Iranian society for a variety of reasons. And also because, as I said, Iranians don't support this foreign policy. I'm not saying it's good or bad. This is my honest assessment, right? I mean, I obviously personally don't support it, but also I think by and large Iranians don't support it for the basic reason that they see the regime's foreign policy as having brought on them nothing but misery, economic isolation, international isolation. You know, the prices go up and people's livelihoods gets worse, and regime leaders give speeches about how much they hate Israel. I mean, that has brought nothing good for Iranian people. So I don't think that will happen in this sense. But of course, look, a war has a logic of its own. If Iran gets attacked, if the territory of our country gets attacked, naturally Iranians will want to defend their country against, you know, against a foreign attack. And that might have a certain effect. I still don't think it would be quite a support for the regime. And also the consequences of it can actually be unpredictable. I mean, they really are unpredictable. There might be, you know, according to what kind of attacks we're talking about. But there won't be anything good. That's from my perspective. An attack by Israel, a direct war breaking out between the two countries will have unpredictable consequences. And at the best, you know, and the best case scenario, I say unpredictable, it could be really terrible in many ways, both in human cost, but also politically. It could empower really forces that are not conducive to our struggles for democracy and progress in Iran. So I don't think there will be support for the regime. But you know, the patriotism of Iranians is, of course, a fact. And they'll naturally want to defend their country if they're attacked.
In your most recent article, I was really struck by the criticism from labor unions. You had one saying that the regime is concluding its final mission to destroy Iran, and another saying, "I spit on anybody supporting this war on either side." In Israel labor unions are very strong and very powerful within society. Is it similar in Iran?
Unfortunately, these trade unions don't have the same kind of institutional power that, let's say Histadrut would have in Israel, obviously, because these are for a large part underground unions in some ways. In the piece I quote, Independent Iranian Workers Union, which is an umbrella union that includes, you know, thousands of workers, but it's very much it's very much run by workers activists and has sort of an underground character. So it's not, it doesn't represent, the mass of the workers the way a regular trade union would do. The other one, which is the Coordination Council of Teachers Unions, that I think has a more direct power. It really does include tons of teachers across the country, but they don't have the same power, as I said, as Histadrut of trade union confederations in democratic countries, just because they're repressed at every turn. But I think they do represent a very important opinion stream, if you will, in Iran, of civic associations, of trade unions, of civil society. We love this term in Iran. We use it a lot, civil society, but we basically mean organizations that are not with the government and often against the government, and that organize ordinary citizens, women, workers, youth. I mean, really, I think gives you a taste. They don't want a war with Israel. I mean, I think there's a very strong anti-war streak in Iran. We've experienced war in the 1980s. It was terrible, virtually terrible. If you talk to veterans of the war, people who have lived through it, they do anything for them not to repeat that. And as I said, again, it's not some sort of a nice point that I just want to make. It's just the fact that Iranians don't have the kind of hostility to Israel that, frankly, you do have, I think, in many Arab countries. It's just not the same thing for us. I mean, and again, I'm just stating that as a sociological fact. It's just not the same thing, because Iran has not historically been in a conflict with Israel, and it doesn't seem to be in our national interest to be. There are some, of course, there's a minority who believe no, Israel is the enemy of Iran and we should fight them and all that, right? They exist, but I think based on my understanding of society and sort of civic sphere, that they're in a small minority. There are those people who very loudly say that Iran should have nothing to fight against Israel. And in fact, people who argue that very much at the top priority of Iran should be making peace with Israel. These are not just trade unionists and like peace leaders or people like that. They're some of the establishment figures of the Islamic Republic of Iran, even, former diplomats, characters like that. I mentioned some of them in my book. I try to usually bring them in my writing. It takes a high price to say stuff like that, so they're not always able to say it, but nevertheless they do say it both publicly and privately. We have no reason to want to fight Israel. Iran and Israel are the two very powerful countries in the region, regardless of who is ruling, and we have it's just not in our national interest to want to go to war.
Thank you so much, Arash Azizi, both for your time and for your incredible insight into something that so many Israelis and people in the West just have no idea about. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us for this special edition of Haaretz's podcast. And thank you to my guests, Aluf Ben and Arash Azizi, and to my producer and editor, Ne'ara Malkin. This was Linda Dayan, and you will be joined soon enough by Allison Kaplan-Summer, who will be returning to host the Haaretz Weekly podcast. Thank you for joining us.